UCR podcast.
Boy, let me say a quick thank you to my buddy Ken for reaching out and offering today's conversation with Zach Starkey. Many of you have known Zach for the past three decades as the drummer for The Who. He had a pretty dramatic 2025 in that regard, which has been pretty well covered. So we don't really get into that here today, but you can certainly read plenty about it at the UCR website. Zach is a character. It was fun to talk about all things Who with him, plus some Oasis, a bit of Joe Walsh. I even got the thumbnail sketch on how he ended up drumming on Power Bill by the Semantics. For those of you out there who remember that band, and I was a bit surprised by the name he threw back at me, it's proof that that guy was really connected to everything in the 80s and 90s, including Zach and the Semantics. Anyway, I enjoyed speaking with Zach, and the reason that we are talking today is because he's going to debut his one-man show, Zach Starkey, Who? An Evening with Zach Starkey, that is happening February 20th at the Gramercy Theater in New York City. And you can get tickets for that via Live Nation or thegramercytheater.com. That's thegramercytheater.com. And theater is T-H-E-A-T-R-E. Read lots more about Zach and The Who at ultimateclassicrock.com. And enjoy our conversation with the one, the only, Zach Starkey. Are you up to anything good studio-wise?
I'm building my show for the Gramercy.
Fantastic, man.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I just found a 20-minute a home video of me and Roger Daltrey and Rabbit Bundrick, keyboard player with The Who, having a meeting before the show at Shoreline Amphitheatre in San Francisco. And Roger's talking about Magic Bus, but Rabbit thinks he's talking about Drowned. And they're completely confused. And after 10 minutes, Rabbit says, "What song is it again?" Now, I don't know if I can put that in the show or not, but it's pretty funny stuff, you know? Roger's saying, what would really help would be if we could rehearse. And we're already 15 shows into the tour, right? And we've not rehearsed, and we haven't even sound checked, you know? And then I've got home movies that are shot from the side of my stage by my daughter, Tasha, that are, we're on fire, man. It's blistering heat on that stage. It's me, John, Roger, Peter, Rabbit. It's stripped down and it's like Gladiator.
That's so cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's like Gladiator with the guitars and like we used to play for nearly 3 hours, you know.
Yeah, they were pretty insane shows. I got a chance to see a number of them, including the 96 tour, where you really kind of first officially toured with the band, man. And, I mean, you guys were always on fire.
I found a lot of stuff as well, home movies of that tour with Billy Idol and PJ Proby.
I love hearing you talk about being basically 15 shows into that tour, that video footage you were watching, and Roger saying he wanted to rehearse. It seems like that was basically life with The Who. That band was always kind of walking the wire. Like,
that's why it's so good, I think, because Piers like wrote that stuff, yeah, and he probably spent years in a shed in his garden writing it. And yeah, when we came to rehearse, he would like be the most unprepared person in the room, and basically he said to me a couple of times, you know, rehearsals is having a cup of tea and saying hi. And then and then they'd be sort of walking around trying to find ways to leave. Well, like waiting for an excuse to go before we did anything. So sometimes we'd do 2 days rehearsal and play maybe 40 minutes. And we'd only ever play songs that we didn't play on the tour. And then we did the sound check. And John would always say, well, I know it. But you don't know it because you never know what's going to happen because people at YP doesn't prepare, I think, right? I think is because he would come on the first show and play more Clams than Marine Boy, right? But
yeah.
But what he's doing is finding a new way to do it and develop a new theme so that he's not bored. And it's not, you know, like there's a lot of bands today who think a great show is when they do it as good as rehearsals. What is that? You know, what is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is that? That's like, you might as well be in the army. The whole point of music is empathy and chemistry, and the greatest band I've seen in the last 20 years is Stone Roses, because the only band I've seen with any chemistry. They sounded like, I don't go to watch bands very often, me and my wife, and when we do, we always pay. Like when we went to Stooges, Raw Power, we paid. They never earned any fucking money, right? And we insisted, right? It's £32 each, we'll fucking pay, right? And we listened to Raw Power every day. I'll get back to the Roses for about 10 days. And we go, this is so good. And within 2 minutes of the band being on stage without Iggy, it was already better than Raw Power at the record, you know? And then Iggy came out, and it was like within 20 minutes, my wife was shouting, get your cock out. And I'm thinking, you haven't said that to me for 7 years.
Right? Yeah.
So then with the Roses, it was the same. We listened to the Roses' first album like over and over again for 2 weeks. And then we went to see them, and I'm thinking, they can never be as good as that. And they fucking were about 100 times better than that. And they said, I've never seen, I've not seen a British band like that since I saw The Who in 1975.
What sticks with you about that Who show from 75?
That I just watched Pete. I didn't watch Keith. I went there because I loved the, you know, I mean, I just started drumming because of The Who. But I was mesmerized by Pete Townsend. I mean, I played the guitar when I was seven. I'd only been playing guitar for 3 years. But I was just watched Pete. And I go and watch all these bands, these amazing drums. You know, I used to want to watch The Meters, so I just watched Leo. You know, I didn't watch Zig, right? Or I'm trying to think of who else, you know, like, it's just a thing, you know, like, I don't know. But I just remember that gig with The Who at 75 being like so. It was a Christmas show. You know, who always used to come back from a US tour and put a couple of shows in for the kids in Britain, you know, and it was, mm-hmm. and it was, they did two nights, and I went the second night, and it was it's the greatest rock and roll you ever seen, right? Because it's the same tour as that footage from, you know, Pontiac Silverdome.
Sure, yeah.
Roadrunner, My Generation Blues,
mm-hmm.
which becomes one of the great moments in rock is when it speeds up towards the end. But to me, rock and roll has, there's a few moments where you can really go, wow, okay, that now I understand what rock and roll is. The other one is Jerry Lee Lewis in a TV series called All You Need Is Love by Tony Palmer. And he's in a little studio of a low ceiling, and he's right in the camera, and he is the devil, boy. He is the devil, right? And that summed up what rock and roll is, you know? He does this thing, like, meat man, you know I am, you know? So it's really like fucking, this is down to the most primal you can go with it, you know, and the end of that My Generation Blues and Roadrunner thing is like they're getting faster and faster, but no one's really doing anything apart from getting more intense. No one's showing off, no one's like, no one's like, you know, doing a solo, no one's doing fuck all. It's just getting so fucking intense that you're watching TV and sweating, you know. And there's about three TV things that when I watch them, my wife says, you know, every hair on your body's gone like barbed wire. Another one is Mark Bolan and Mickey Finn in Boards of Boogie when they get on the carpet and do their thing together and they're just looking at each other's eyes. And that one, my whole body goes like rigid, you know.
I know that you're a huge Sex Pistols fan, but you mentioned Iggy. If we go back to Iggy for a moment, I think that as a music fan, it certainly was a moment for me when I started seeing people like Iggy and the Stooges, or even just Iggy playing shows on his own. It's a moment as a music fan when you see somebody like Iggy do the thing.
Yeah, but they're doing the thing that everybody else is trying to do, but they can't do it in it. You know, Iggy, it's like Iggy and Stooges are like responsible for so many other groups, aren't they? Alice Cooper. But Alice, you know, Iggy and Stooges is singing about scoring and that, and Alice Cooper's singing. And I love Alice Cooper, don't get me wrong. I went sure. to my first fancy dress as Alice Cooper when I was seven. Right? But he's singing about cheating on math tests, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Stooges is not singing about that. They're singing about really, like, just, like, grubby, dirty things, you know?
Yeah.
Alice Cooper was kind of like, he's so outrageous and so, like, freaked so many people out. But if you listen to the words, it's not like very threatening. I mean, you know, it's not school's out. You know, don't, you know, like school's out for Iggy and the Stooges because I'm like so stoned they can't get there. You know, I think I read something of Iggy where he says, and Alice just took it and commercialized it. And and the thing about Iggy is, I don't begrudge him that. You know, he's a smart guy. And Alice is a smart guy. And that whole, and I love Alice Cooper so much. I got into T-Rex first, and then I got into Alice Cooper, and then I got into like, glam bands, British glam bands like Slade, Mud, you know, right? And fantastic pop music, really fantastic pop music, you know. Yeah, that's what the Stooges never sort of happened here, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
It didn't really happen there either. You know, it was too heavy for anyone except, you know, Andy Warhol or something, you know.
Yeah, I think there were folks like Iggy and Alice, any of these bands that you want to name, that perhaps they didn't happen in a way at the time because it was a lot for people to comprehend in the live setting. It's one thing to hear it on the record, but you have that thrown in front of you, especially if you've never heard it before, you're like, what is this?
And the records were so, like, gnarly and real and compared to the sort of fairy tale land of rock and roll music, you know, that was being burned out, you know, by 1970, you know. I love Funhouse. That's my favorite album is Funhouse, you know. You know, really, you know, that's like the Stooges, isn't it? But I love Raw Power because it had James Williamson. Ed Cool once, right, when, what year did they toured England in, or Europe, I can't remember, 2010, 2011, 2012. And I get a call from Johnny Marr and Scott, the drummer, was sick. Remember, he was hospitalized. I called from Johnny Marr and the message that he left said, "Hey, Zach, no biggie, but my hero, James Williamson, has called me and said they need a drummer, late 30s, early 40s, with a good haircut. Do you know anyone?" Right? And 10 minutes later, the phone goes again. Eddie Vedder. "Oh, Iggy just called me, man, and he needs a drummer. I told him that you're the guy for it." I said, tell him I'll do it for nothing because we owe him so much. And I went, "Hang on, don't. Let's think about this." Right. And then so I heard from Iggy's manager, who I know, Henry, but I'd worked with him when I played with Mike Scott from the Waterboys.
Sure.
And I said, "Tell Iggy I don't need to rehearse. I know it." And I get a message back. He said, "We'll be rehearsing every day for 3 days. Whatever you think." And I booked the rehearsal room for myself because I wanted to learn it all properly before I met with Iggy. I met them. And I was writing out the songs, right? The best way to learn a song is to actually listen to it, not to play it first. Write down how it goes. And then once you've written it, you never look at it again. And in the middle of writing out all these songs, I get a call again. "Oh, Iggy's solo band drummer has got a dep for the group he was touring with. So he's going to do it because he knows it. So I don't need you." And then the phone went again. It was Eddie Vedder. And he went, "Kind of a relief, huh?" Right. But it was kind of a relief. But it was like, you know, you had to do it because we owe them guys. We owe them so much. We know bands like Primal Scream, stuff like that. You know, we're out of the Stooges and there'd be no Pistols. There'd be none of that, you know.
Drummers seem to be one way or another. How did you get into writing out songs like that?
Because I used to get calls like, say Mike Scott, for instance, well, if you want to learn a song, and when I was a kid, I used to play along to records to learn drums. I only ever had one drum lesson from my father. Yeah, everyone thinks of Keith Moon, but me and Keith just used to sit and drink beer and talk about girls and surfing, and this is the Beach Boys. We never played drums together. But he was my inspiration, you know. I think he's clever to do that, actually, because he inspired me in so many ways without ever having to sit at a drum kit. So I get a call from, like, Mike Scott, and I had to learn 3 hours of music in 36 hours. And the best way, and you could sit there and listen to it, you know, or you sit there and play to it, you're not really taking it in. You have to know it. Mike is like the only person I think I worked with that I wasn't completely familiar with everything he'd done. I'm a very lucky guy because every gig I've ever had has not been a job. it's already been a band that I like or love, and I know it. Right, but with Mike, it was 3 hours, and it was like, you know, just these crazy tunes. Like, anyone here seen Hank? I never heard him in my life, you know. So I just figured the best way to learn stuff is to actually listen to it and write out, you know, that bit goes like that, and that bit goes like that, and then that bit's 4 bars or whatever, and then you read that, and then you just throw that away, and it's in. So you're not counting. And I remember, like, when we played a gig with, it was The Who, but it's the same rhythm section. Me and Pino played with The Who, Jeff Beck, Debbie Harry. I think Brian Adams did a little bit, maybe. But, and we'd never played joined together since I'd played with The Who, you know?
Yeah.
And Pete said, look, we're going to do joined together. Could you analyze it, please? I said, I'll do it after lunch. Pete went, we said anything about lunch. See, I know it's an amazing memory, dude. Like, I can remember word for word where I know Paul Cook came to see me at that sound check, sitting on the riser, and Pete went, what the fuck are you doing here, Cookie? So writing it out, or listening and writing it out, and then just throw it away, yeah. But it's better than just diving in and trying to learn it as you play along with it, because you're guessing.
I found it interesting hearing you say recently that you had learned rudiments from the drummer from Kasabian, and that really turned things around for you playing-wise. Like, what was the kind of this important switch that got flipped, you know, learning those rudiments?
He just watched me play and went, you know, I could make you better. And in Kasabian supported The Who in 2000, very early 2004. I think when their first single came out, and their album wasn't out yet. And I'd heard of them because there was a moment when I started working with Oasis, which was before that, where it was like, okay, let's check these guys out. What are they like? You know, and then we sat in the studio, Oasis studio, and watched Kasabian's first video. And it was pretty much an all-round thumbs up. But there's something wrong with that singer, isn't there? Yeah, he's going fucking amazing, isn't he? Like, so they opened for The Who in Cardiff or Swansea at Birmingham. And next time I saw him was at Benicassim Festival in Spain with Oasis. And it was booked as Kasabian Midnight. You know, things happen late in Europe because of the siesta and all that stuff. It's like Kasabian Midnight and Oasis at 2 a.m. And Noel said, fuck that, I'm not going on at 2 a.m. Switch it around. Now, we just had 3 weeks off from our tour, Oasis, and we all been just sitting on our asses doing nothing, right? You know, not playing music, right? So they switched it. Now, as we walked to the stage with Kasabian to watch them, Tom, the singer, came up to me and went, legend, you showed us, you held the door open of catering, and you showed us where the soup was. No one's ever done that. I don't remember doing it, but I was just like, you know, helping out some young guys who'd like never done this before, you know. But they just remembered that, and we were firm friends from that minute on, you know. And so anyway, they came on before us. Oh, so Noel switched it. So we were on Midnight, Kasabian on at 2, yeah. So they're following us. They're headlining. And we did our thing, and we were a bit slack, man. We had 3 weeks off. We were a bit slack. And then Kasabian came on and fucking destroyed us. They had a fucking 20-minute drum solo, like Led Zeppelin or something. They just like, whoa. And right in the middle of it, Tom went, this one's for Liam and Noel, you fuckers. And Liam looked at me and went, did he really say that? Right, but there, they kicked our ass. The greatest thing that could happen to Oasis at that moment was for a band to do that, because we stepped up, and in 2 shows, we were kicking their ass. Yeah. It's a very healthy thing, that. And then Oasis would never only have bands open that they like, or they wanted to know, they wanted to know about, you know, like Arctic Monkeys, or we had the Coral a lot, we had Shaq a lot, you know, the bands they really dug, you know. And the thing about Oasis that is amazing is, and I've never seen it before, probably never see it again, is every night they would go, as soon as the support band started, they'd go up to the side of the stage and watch the whole show and then clap the band off every night. Wow. because they're psyching themselves up. That's why they're doing it. No, I've never known anyone do that. Everyone's downstairs like, you know, going, I've got to get rid of my gig, man.
It was really interesting to see this most recent Oasis tour, because people were saying, you know, the band finally is getting its due, which is weird to say about a band like Oasis. But, you know, Liam said the whole thing was biblical, and it really was something watching those two guys come out like prize fighters every night and just destroy both here and in Europe, man. They were just, I think they were at a level that a lot of people, whether they were longtime fans or people had never seen the band, longtime fans especially, never thought they were going to see them on that level again. And they just went out there and destroyed.
Yeah, of course. I didn't see it, quite honestly, right? But I imagine it was amazing. Maybe a bit fast. Slow it on down.
The reason I brought that up was just like, all the time you played with Oasis, it's surprising that in 2025, people would still be wondering what they're going to get from Oasis. But I guess in a sense, like The Who, that's kind of the unexpected element of Oasis. They always went with an element of unpredictability.
Musically, I don't know how it was, because I didn't see it, so I can't really comment. But sure. when I played with them, they were the greatest people I'd ever worked with, the most inspiring, the most hardworking, and the most grateful band I'd ever met. And the only band I ever met, I didn't complain about anything.
Yeah, 100%.
We were great. And we'd play, you know, every show had 8 songs from a new record in it. And we'd start with a new one, and the fans would know it, you know. That's amazing.
With this one-man show, what's it been like for you going through the video footage? Like you talked about the Shoreline footage early on, and it seems like it's probably been pretty instructive for you going through all this stuff.
It's been, like, quite emotional, actually.
Sure.
Because, you know, well, there's so much of it, because there's so much of it. It's like, you know, what I'm trying to do with the show is start it with a film, yeah, that will an informative film. So I've done my first 7 minutes, and it's all about my family and stuff, you know, and the bands that I'm very, very close to, who are family, and it's really quite emotional indeed, you know. And then there's another 15 minutes where it's just gone like careerist bullshit, right? But still great. It's Jeff Beck, and like I said, you know, I've only played with people I thought were amazing. I'm very lucky. And so starting with a film that will sort of like give the Q&A some fuel, right?
Sure.
Otherwise, Q&A is going to be guesswork, isn't it? I mean, they're not going to know that I cut 80 tracks with Sly and Robbie when I played the guitar, unless they could see it. You know, they're not going to know that I was in a band with Bobby and Andrew from Primal Scream and Glenn Matlock. They're not going to know that me and my wife had a band called Shush Pistols with Glenn and Paul, right? They're just not going to know unless they see it. You know, not going to play with Gary Brooker or Joe Walsh. I've got home movies from Joe's tour, you know. And then I'm going to come out and after the film, come out and do a very recognizable short drum solo that's less than a minute. You might know what I mean. All right?
Yeah.
And then get straight into a Q&A while it's fresh. And then I'm going to have all the rest of the stuff, which is basically it's footage of me playing with all these bands. But with AI, you take the drums out, right? So I make a click track from the existing drum, take them out, and then these guys will be on the screen, and I'll be playing the drums live with like Liam, Noel, and Pete Rodge, you know, Johnny Marr, well, with everyone, you know. And there's a few things that are going to be a surprise. So I try not to talk about them, but get really excited and want to tell everyone, you know. And I don't think this has been done before, right? But that's basically how the show goes. Then we'll stop, and Marky Ramone's going to come and ask me some questions, and I'm going to ask him some. And then probably have another Q&A, but I'm hoping the Q&As will lead into whatever I play next, rather than have a set list that I've got to stick to, right? And have the audience participate more than usual. I'm hoping that'll work. And then finish with, of course, with The Who, because you can't follow it. So I've been doing some sort of remixes of Who stuff that Pete's given me to use. And like it's like the backing tracks that we play to live, but once you put some like dubby shit on it and that, you don't need drums on it. I mean, I'd rather sit in the fucking audience and watch this, you know. It's really cool. It's really cool.
How'd you land on Markey as the guy to have the conversation with?
Well, because I know him pretty good, and he's a New York guy, and we're in New York, and we're paying our respects to New York, because he's the greatest gig ever played, his concert for New York. And Markey is going to ask the right questions, I think.
That's fantastic.
And also, he's a complete original, isn't he? There's only one Markey. You know, you couldn't. No one else could play the drums like Markey. No one else can do that. Have you seen him do it? It's like, it looks like there's something wrong with him. So weird and amazing. Yeah.
I think back to what you were saying about Pete telling you to take Join together and analyze it. And I think that's probably been one component that's been interesting about putting this show together for you, is going back and analyzing that work and really getting forensic with it in a Pete Townsend kind of way, in that sense.
A little bit. I mean, I've taken the backing tracks for like Wanting It Fooled Again, say, or Barbara O'Reilly, and I've sampled John's bass from like live bootlegs and dropped it on it. And because it's to a click track, it just drops. So when I play those songs, John will be doing it with me out on the screen.
Fantastic.
Yeah, left-handed in that one and right-handed in that one.
What did you learn about John Entwistle living with the Ox?
Man, I want to say for the show, but, you know, I learned how to be a rock star now, how to act like a rock star and how not to, you know, an awful lot. Don't buy 14 American cars if you can't drive. I've got footage of that as well, a lot of photographs, and it's amazing just to live up there with John, you know, because it's like we're on John time. It's actually quite regular. You know, you get up at noon, come downstairs, do the sun crossword, eat a packet of chocolate biscuits, have a brandy coffee. Then we go to work. 6 o'clock, stop for dinner. Hour for dinner. 7 o'clock, he go practice his bass for 1 hour every night till 8. Then we go back to work, right? And then we'd finish at 2, watch a movie, go to bed. So he's kind of like, John was at his own clock, but that's how we worked. And every Thursday, we'd have a curry, and then we couldn't work after it, so we'd have pie. And on Friday, we sort of try and work for a couple of hours, and at 3 o'clock, go, let's just go back to London.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a rhythm section. It sounds like you guys like locked immediately. Like, what do you think it is that locked you guys so naturally like that?
I don't know. It happens with certain people, and it doesn't happen with everyone. That's what I'm saying. I'm lucky because it's happened with almost everybody I've worked with. Me and John jammed at a party when I was 14 years old, and it just went like that. And then John kind of hunted me down. He used to come to all my band gigs, trying to get me to join his band when I was like 15, 16, and I was loyal to my group. Well, I wouldn't. And then at 19, he asked me again. That's when I went and lived at his place. He's a great guy, man. He's like the heart of the Who. I don't really know what the other guys are. I think Keith might be the soul. Pete may be the brains. And Roger may be the front cover and the voice.
Yeah, you've talked about how you don't look to replicate what Keith Moon played on record. That's not what a drummer should do. But what should people perhaps know about Keith's approach as a player that they are not necessarily going to realize listening to the songs and albums?
That Keith plays the words. He's playing to Roger's singing more than anything. Who's an odd band? It's a bit like Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and The Who are all the same. It's about the bass. It's about the guitar leading the drums, and then the bass has to follow. And those three bands are like that. And those three bands take risks every night. And those three bands are sadly missing out of most bands now.
Yeah, and in an interview, and you've talked about this here today as well, you have talked about the moments that you would play along with the Who albums as they were blasting on a boombox. And I would imagine, obviously, the experience of playing with the real Who was markedly different. Like, what was kind of your initial takeaway doing that early on?
Well, it was fucking terrifying. You know, they were there. But they were like, Peter's right in my face, you know. It's like, it was real, you know. Over the boombox, I could hear Pete and Roger, really, so I couldn't copy Keith because I couldn't really hear it. So I just do what I thought he was doing. But I was also playing to records like Nevermind the Bollocks and Damn, Damn, Damned and New Boots and Panty by Ian Dury. So I was playing to Long Said on the record, but then you get in a room with The Who and it's like, wow. It's like, well, I didn't realise that this whole thing is going to be a jam. I had no idea that we're going to just jam every song. We're never going to know what's going to happen, but John and Roger were easy with that, you know, back then. It was just like they knew it was going to be like that. Well, I had no idea until we got out there that it was like bebop, the amps, you know?
Yeah, I think when you talked earlier about, you know, Pete really kind of working to find his way into the material each night and keeping it fresh like that, it makes a lot of sense when you consider the creative guy that he is. Like, I just think about the fact that
he's not happy to be bored. Right. No, he doesn't want to be bored. He'd rather be surprised. Got to be surprised than bored. So, you know, if I became aware very early that if I played the same drum fill two nights running, he'd sort of look like this.
Sure.
I've heard that. So it forces you to be as creative as he's been. And that's why I'm kind of like doing my own show, because I'm fucked, aren't I? Because no other bands do that. Right. Pete's put the bar so high, and I said this to him, that I'm fucked. And he went, I know.
It seems like you still have contact with those guys, right?
I texted him and Pete the night before last about my show.
Yeah.
I spoke to Roger last week. Been about a long time, you know. We'd always go. Pete's just, he's happy about the show. He's wishing me luck. He wishes he could be there, but he's not there. He's not in the country, you know. And he knows that I'll do his music proud because I love The Who, you know. I'm not going to go out there and make it, you know, I'm doing something different with it, that's for sure. But he knows I'm going to do it right.
There was a moment early on when you first were dismissed from the band where you talked about how either Roger or Pete was like, don't come get your drums yet. So how final are things at this point? Like, did you ever get your drums? Like, is there a door still open, do you think?
That was the third time. After I got fired twice, that happened. That Roger called me because, well, I'm not going to say why, because I recommended a drummer to them who turned it down. And then Roger called me and said, look, we might want you back. And then an article came out where I was promoting my group single, Mantra of the Cosmos, yeah?
Sure.
And the journalist who I spoke to had watched the show on YouTube. And you said, look, I watched the show and you didn't do anything wrong. And I went, look, he got it wrong, I got it right. And that came out in the newspaper. I got fired here. That's it. But that was the third time. But through all that, I just went, you know, it's a Who. It's not like, it's not really, it wasn't phasing me madly because it's the Who. They're nuts. And if they weren't nuts, you wouldn't have this amazing music, you know. You wouldn't have any of it if they weren't like that, you know. They don't know what they fucking want either. You know, they're just like nuts. And that's why they're great, isn't it? I mean, I remember watching a bootleg, 2-hour bootleg on a bus with Noel Gallagher, who had 2-hour bootleg of The Who stuff. And at the end, he just went, that is the maddest band I've ever seen. Call Me Lightning, all those crazy videos they made, like, you know, all that stuff was on it. Right? It was given to me by a guy called Matt Kent, who's like, he was running Pete's website and he's got a Who tattoo on his calf. And me and Noel watched it. And at the end, Noel was just like, that's the maddest band I've ever seen. And they are like that, hang on. And that's what creates what we love, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah, man. Well, going back to just you being a drummer early on, ultimately, I imagine it's probably getting thrown into the fire with a certain gig or tour that really kind of sets you on your proper path. Like, what's kind of the moment that you remember where you felt like you were really finding your mojo behind the kit?
I played this band with Icicle Works in about 1988.
Sure.
And a year before that, I played with Bobby Womack. I think both Bobby and Ian from the High School Works, yeah, sort of like, okay, they made me feel like I was doing a good job.
Those Bobby shows must have been something else, man.
Bobby was like, you know, he was so cool and so fiery, but so great. I mean, I was playing with Boy George, and I was playing like a reggae beat, and I look up, and Bobby was dancing around my drums, going, you're going to be in my band, you're going to be in my band. That was when I was like, that's in 87. And that was a hell of an experience to be in Bob's band. Yeah? Now you can imagine.
I love that you got to know Toots as well, like Toots and the Maytals. Like, you know, Toots, just reggae stuff in general. What did that kind of do for your playing overall, do you think?
Toots would, when we recorded with Toots, Toots would sing parts. He was sitting next to me with headphones on. We'd have my amp blasting our minds away. And he would just sing parts and I'd have to work them out. And then play them with conviction immediately. And then I would go, okay, hang on, we finished the song. Okay, I'm going to go upstairs to the control room and check it out. And I got upstairs and I said, you want to hear it? I said, no, I just want to fucking lie down for a minute. That was so intense. I was like, fuck, fuck. Like that. And then at the bottom of the stairs, Tuesday goes, Zachary, next tune, man, next tune. And we do the next one. We were with Toots on and off for about 4 years. He's the greatest singer I think I'll ever meet. I'm trying to finish his, he bequeathed me his Toots Sings Otis record.
Oh, wow.
And, Keith already played on Satisfaction, and I'm trying to finish it. I've got a lot on at the moment, but I will finish it because that's what we said I'd do when he got sick.
You mentioned Mantra of the Cosmos. What's happening there?
Well, everyone's a bit busy at the moment, like riding on the shoulder of Oasis, that ripple effect, which made all these bands huge again, you know?
Yeah, so, for sure. So
everyone's a bit busy, but I've still got a triple album here that's nearly just about done, really. And the thing about albums are someone's got to pay to market them, or no one's ever going to hear it. I have the product, but I don't have the resources to market it. And you really do need that.
Last few things here, man. You mentioned Eddie Vedder at one point. What's the bond that you and Eddie struck?
The bond was in 1999, I didn't know Eddie, and he opened for The Who at the House of Blues in Chicago. And he did a song called Soldier of Love in a punk way. He had a band called C Average from Seattle with him, I think. They did a song called Soldier of Love by Arthur Alexander. And I love Arthur Alexander. And we bonded over Arthur.
That's fantastic, man.
Later, we bonded over The Who, because without The Who, there would be no Eddie Vedder, you know.
You're one of those guys that, as you've mentioned, you've gotten to play with Joe Walsh. What do you appreciate about Joe, the player and the songwriter, because his music...
Well, I love that. Joe's a futurist as well, you know. He had so many, like, drum machines and sequences and just so... He's a futurist, you know. He wasn't one of these guys trying to ban drum machines. He was one of these guys like Sly Dunbar, who's actually getting inside them, you know, or Pete, you know, getting inside these things, you know. And I love that about Joe. And then when I toured with him, it was, you know, he used to go, don't play behind. I'll play behind you and you'll sound peppy. That's amazing. He's right about that. You know, he sits behind me and my drums sound like wide awake. But if I try to sit behind him and we sound sleepy, yeah? And, you know, the other guitarist who I noticed did that naturally, Johnny Depp.
Oh, yeah, sure.
He sits behind the drums in a brilliant way and makes the drums sound wide awake.
You're right about Joe and technology, though. I'm glad you mentioned that, though, because I think of a song like The Confessor. Like, he has so many songs that sound so cool because of the technology that he was curious about and embraced at the time.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I think, you know, the future is the future, isn't it? It's not going to go away.
Sure.
Right? I'm not that fucked about it. I'm not going to bother about AI, really. I think it's a good sort of a tool that could be helpful. And also that, you know, everyone's worried about AI and music. And I not think that's a bit of a smokescreen for AI and politics.
All right, man. You played on something that I'm curious about, because I dig the record you did with the Semantics. How did you get in the mix with those guys?
I got a call from John Kolodna at Geffen Records saying, you need to go and play these guys. They'll suit you. And I moved to Nashville for like a couple of months and we rehearsed and then went to LA, signed a deal with Geffen. And when record deals took a whole week with a lawyer to go through, you know, it's so ridiculous, like 80 pages. You know? And we made a great record with Peter Asher producing and great songs. And then right at the last minute, we were dropped for Weezer.
Oh, wow.
Well, you know, Weezer pretty good. Right?
How'd you know John Kolodna?
He just used to call me to get me to go to LA and play all these groups he thought he might. He goes, I'm thinking about signing this band. The drummers, they need a good drummer. You go to LA and play with them. And then I'll come and watch them after you rehearse them a couple of weeks. And that happened 3 or 4 times with John, you know. Yeah. I don't know where he is now. I wish I did. I'd love to talk to him because he was really an inspiration.
Wrapping things up here, if you're going to give somebody the first thing to listen to from The Who, what's a good gateway?
Meaty, Beaty, Big and Bouncy. That was my gateway.
What was it about that record you loved?
The excitement and the anarchy and just the great songs. The sound.
Yeah.
You know, it's raw. It's the singles from all the singles of the 60s. And it just, I never heard anything like it when I heard it. I was into glam rock, you know, it's very sort of, you know, dense, analog-y sound. And then this sort of things sounded like it's coming out of tin cans, but it still blow your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, this show, man, this show's going to be a lot of fun. What ultimately, you're very excited about this show. What do you want folks to take away from this show?
That music's great fun, and everyone needs to get in their garage and start a garage band like the Stooges and stop fucking about all these video games and that. No, music's like, who's to say, Noel Gallagher. It's not a game, and you never get to the top level.
Thank you, man. Thank you for the time here. We're looking forward to the show.
Thank you. I like talking, so hopefully it'll be a good show because, you know, you can't shut me up, can you?
Well, have a good rest of the day on that side, man. Thank you, Zach. Have a good one.
Thanks, brother.
All right, brother. Yeah, take care. We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.